We have been going through Revelation, if you want to look at, turn in your Bibles to Revelation. Revelation 2 and 3 are the letters to the seven churches that we have been looking at over the past few weeks. And I don't know, I wonder to myself, providence is a tricky thing, isn't it? How God works in the world today. I don't know how much involved he is in my topic selection. But it is interesting to me that the letter we're going to look at today, the letter to the church in Smyrna, is a culmination of everything that begins at the birth of Christ, is it not? And the scriptures that I've chosen, again, I wonder how God works in my sermon preparation and in the events of the world. The verses that I've chosen do very much go with the birth of Christ. And what we're going to talk about today is we look at this letter to the church in Smyrna in Revelation 2, 8 through 11, which was read for us. There is one overwhelming theme, and each of these letters has a theme. This theme is victory over death, as he writes to the church in Smyrna. And I want to begin with this question. Why do people fear death? Why do we fear death? It is the one thing, they say, well, two things, death and taxes, right? It's one of the two things that unites all humans everywhere. Everybody is going to have to come to grips with this. At some point, everybody realizes, oh, yeah, I'm going to die. Now, for most of our young lives, we kind of don't think about that. It's like not even in our consciousness. We're indestructible. But at some point, we all come to grips with this idea. I am going to cease to live at some point. And why do we fear that? I think there are four main reasons why we fear that. One, this is the cessation of life, just the things that we do and the things that we enjoy in our families, and that's all going to end when we die. So the stopping of the things that we do while we're alive, the process itself is scary, isn't it? It would be nice to just go in our sleep, never aware of the process that it's happening, but many of us don't get to experience that, so the process itself is scary. Then there's the unknown beyond. What happens after we die? That's one of the four fundamental questions of humanity. One of the four most important questions of humanity as a species. What happens when we die? Is there anything after this life? Is there anything beyond our death? Everybody asks that at some point. Everybody has to come to grips with that question. And then I think the final thing that is scary to us about death is it could happen at any time. I don't know when it's going to happen. I don't know. Why do I not know? Because it's so much out of my control. I can't control the other drivers on the road. I can't control the weather. I can't control, you know, X, Y, or Z, any number of things that might kill me. I can control some things, and I think a lot of our lives are centered around this idea of postponing death as long as we can. But these four things, as we think about the fear of death, what does this fear do to people? This fear drives most of our lives. Most of what we do as biological beings is driven by this fear of death. Hebrews 2, 14 through 15. And we're going to come back to this text at the end of it. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, we're the children, the creation. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. What slavery does the fear of death subject us to? And I put these four things back up there. These four fears, what do they do to our lives? We're going to come back to that. Think about that. What slavery does the fear of death subject us to? We're going to come back to that as we look at this letter to the church in Smyrna. Let's talk about the church in Smyrna. It's easy because we don't know much. I mean, this is basically all we know. This one letter is what we have about the church in Smyrna. Now, we know the city historically was the center for the imperial cult. That is, it was the cult of those who believed the divinity of the Roman emperor, the Caesar, that the emperor was God. And this was the city of Smyrna, was one of the centers of that cult, the imperial cult, those who worshiped Caesar as God. And it's interesting, this is the church for whom Jesus has no condemnation. Nothing bad to say about the church in Smyrna. You remember the church in Ephesus last week. What was his complaint against them? This I have against you. You have abandoned your first love. Repent, therefore, and do the works you did at first. The church in Pergamum, similarly, is going to have some problems, and the church in Thyatira. All of these churches have things that Jesus condemns them for. I don't like this thing that you're doing. But the church in Smyrna, no problems, apparently, at least according to this letter. Nothing that Jesus has to correct. And as we think about the church in Smyrna, really, there are three problems that they were facing, three difficulties that were going on in their lives. The church in Smyrna was facing some tough stuff. Revelation 2, 9, and 10. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. They're going to face some hard times. Number one, poverty. They're facing poverty. And Jesus says they are both poor and rich. I'll put it back up there. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. What is he saying there? Almost certainly talking about physical poverty. They're poor. They don't have a lot of stuff. Maybe some of them don't have places to live. Maybe they don't have enough clothes. Maybe they don't have enough food. Could be any number of things that they're struggling with there, but they are physically poor, but spiritually wealthy. Very literally following the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break and steal, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Might I suggest that this is one of the reasons that Jesus has no condemnation for the church in Smyrna? What does he say at the end there? Where your treasure is, there your heart will be. They don't have physical treasures. They don't have material goods. They only have spiritual wealth. And because of that, their heart is set on spiritual things. This might be one of the reasons why they don't have anything that Jesus needs to correct. How does fear of death relate to wealth and poverty? Doesn't the fear of death drive our materialistic ideals? I don't know when I'm going to die, so I better accumulate as much stuff as I can beforehand. You may have heard the phrase, he who dies with the most toys wins. I mean, really, isn't that how we act? We act as if I'm only going to have these 80 years or whatever it is, and I better accumulate as much and as much and as much as I can. But why? Fundamentally, there's a different reason. Why do we want to accumulate so much wealth, so much physical possessions? Because I know I'm only going to get to live for 80 years, so I better enjoy it as much as I can. I better squeeze every ounce of pleasure out of my physical life. And what I do, or what people do, is when you place your priorities in physical goods, when you think that pleasure is primarily derived from physical things, of course you're going to be chasing after wealth. If all this life is all you have, this 80 years, you better enjoy it as much as you can, because when you die, that's it. So accumulate all you can to enjoy as much as you can. The fear of death drives materialism. It does. Is maybe why the church in Smyrna didn't care so much about their material goods. And why Jesus reminds them, you may not have much physically, but you are rich. You are wealthy, Smyrnans. Second problem they were going to face, the synagogue of Satan. Those who say they are Jews and are not. I'm going to put this back up there. I know your tribulation and your poverty and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Those who say they are Jews and are not. What should have been? You think about the defining characteristic of a Jew. What should have been the one thing that defined a Jew? Shouldn't that have been their relationship with God? Throughout the entire Old Testament, what made a Jew a Jew? It wasn't just nationality, because guess what? If you weren't born with the DNA of a Jew, you could still become a Jew. The idea of proselytizing, okay? You could become a Jew grafted into the Jewish nation. And why? What was the defining characteristic of the Jew? The defining characteristic of the Jew was the relationship with God. And that should have carried over. The Jews should still have had a relationship with God. They had a head start on everybody else. They had the oracles of God. They had that relationship in the Old Testament. And they should have made that transition very easily. After all, to them, the Messiah was born, right? One of them. They should have made that transition very easily. Those who say they are Jews and are not, those who claim to be of this historical lineage of Abraham, who claim to have this relationship with God, but they have abandoned their relationship with God. Remember that Smyrna was a center for the imperial cults, for those who worshipped the emperor as God. And did any other Jews in Scripture forsake God for the whims of the government? Can you think of anybody? Can you think of any of the Jews that might have catered to the whims of the Romans instead of to their God? How about the Jews that put Jesus up for crucifixion? How about the Jews that chased after the church all throughout the book of Acts? Jews that forsook God under the guise of appealing to the Roman government. Caesar, you must take care of these Christians because they're preaching a different king. Caesar, you must take care of this Jesus because he's claiming to be king himself. And so under the guise of appeasing the Roman government, they persecuted Jesus, they put him to death, and that carried on into the book of Acts. So what does Jesus say about them? These who are Jews, who claim to be Jews, claim to have a relationship with God and are not, Jesus condemns them most harshly, identifies them with the supreme enemy. Rather than being a synagogue for God, that is part of the spiritual temple of his church, they were the synagogue of Satan. Satan was the one who lived in them and worked in them. Even though they claimed to be religious, claimed to be godly, their actions clearly demonstrated that they had a different master. Final problem then, this impending persecution, and it all culminates together, the impending persecution that they were about to face. I'll read it again. I'm not going to put it back up there. I know your tribulation and your poverty and the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you in prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Was the devil himself going to carry out this persecution? There's two ways to look at it. The devil, the angelic being of the devil, the fallen angel, was not going to materialize in Smyrna and carry these Jews or these Christians into prison. Okay, he wasn't going to do that. But did he not work through human agents? They're a synagogue of Satan. They're carrying out his works, doing his bidding. And those agents probably didn't even know that they were doing the work of the devil. They were just doing it for selfish reasons. But it ended up serving the devil's goals. Why would Smyrna have feared the persecution? Why would that be something to be afraid of? And he says, don't fear the tribulation you are about to suffer, because that's their natural impulse. The natural impulse is, I'm about to be put in prison. Some of us are about to die. I'm afraid of that. Why? It all goes back to the fear of death. These Smyrnans, a lot of them were going to die because of this tribulation. That is a scary thing. It's primal. It's instinctual. We all understand the fear of death. And they were warned, things are going to get bad. Things are going to get really bad for you guys, but be faithful. Three times in his letter to Smyrna, Jesus talks about death. Three times the word, it's like three verses, once per verse, Jesus mentions death. Revelation 2:10b, be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. That's what he says in response to this. You're going to be persecuted. Some of you are going to be thrown into prison. But be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Was it possible that the Smyrnian Christians would die? Absolutely it was. But does a Christian have to die for Jesus to be faithful? That is to say, does your death have to be a direct result of your Christianity in order to be in heaven? I hope not. Many Christians have died throughout history that their death was not a direct result of their Christianity. Think about a Christian who dies in a car wreck. Well, that wasn't a result of their Christianity. That might have been an idiot driver. Maybe there was a drunk driver. Maybe the roads were bad. Maybe they fell asleep. Any number of reasons why they could have died there, and it wasn't a direct result of their Christianity, yet I would submit that they're still in heaven. So it's not saying that you have to die as a direct result of your Christianity to be faithful. I think it would be better said, be faithful until you die, whenever that might be. And for some of the Smyrnans, it was going to be sooner rather than later. Some of you might die. Be faithful until you die. But some of them were not going to be dead. Some of them were going to live. Some of them were going to endure after. And here's the question. Which is harder? Dying for Christ or living for him? Which of those is more difficult? I could see it either way. Couldn't you? On the one hand, I don't want to die. The process of dying is scary. I don't want to go through that process. And it would be difficult, I think, and if we lived in a place where this was happening, it's happening in places in the world, where all it would take would for me to renounce Jesus and I could keep on living. That's a difficult thing, to die for something you believe in. But on the other hand, if we truly believe the tenets of Christianity, isn't death the better option? What does Paul say? I long to die and be with the Lord, for that is much better for me. To live is Christ, but to die is gain. And Paul understood that on an instinctual or a fundamental level, that death was the more desirable option. Yet I long to remain with you, for that is more fruitful for you, as Paul says. Living for Christ, I would submit, is just as hard as dying for him. The daily grind of day after day service and sacrifice, that's difficult in a different way than dying. Both are difficult. Both are hard. But they're difficult in different ways, aren't they? It takes a lot of endurance to live day after day and sacrifice and put someone else first. It's difficult. It's hard. In a different way than dying for Christ is hard. What empowers us to live without the fear of death? Because isn't that what Jesus is saying to this church? You do not have to fear death. Be faithful until you die and I will give you a crown of life. What enables us to move past this fear of death and the slavery of the fear of death? What does that do to us? It shapes so much of how we live. If death is coming at any moment, I don't know when it could come, I better enjoy as much of life as I can right now. And I'm going to shape my life around things that will not lead me into danger, physical danger, because I want to live, I want to survive, and that shapes so much of it. What empowers us as Christians to live without that fear? He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. That phrase, second death, is interesting. It doesn't appear very often in Scripture. What is the first death? I think we all know what that is, right? Hebrews 9:27. And just as is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, we're all going to die. You're going to die, I'm going to die, unless Jesus comes back first. But that physical death, that's the first death. What's the second death then? But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, the murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Wait, so now I'm not only afraid of one death, but I'm afraid of two? I've just doubled my fear? That's what we're talking about? I mean, really, isn't that what it's... I mean, think about that. Not only do I have to be afraid of the cessation of physical life, but now I have this extra thing to be afraid of, but that's not Jesus' point at all. One who conquers, what does he say? I'll put it back up there. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. And it's interesting what Jesus says. He doesn't promise them that they're going to live. He doesn't promise them that they're not going to die physically. Everybody's going to die physically. That's going to happen. How can we live without fear of that? And more importantly, how can we live without the fear of this second death? The second death does not sound nice, guys. Their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death, eternal separation from God. That's not something I want to go through. How do I get past that? How can I live without that fear? What frees us from that fear? Revelation 2:8. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. Description of Jesus, pulled from Revelation 1:9-20. Who is Jesus? And I'm going to look at this every week. The first and the last. Now you could compare with 1:8, Revelation 1:8 and Revelation 22:13, this idea of the Alpha and the Omega, first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. The first and the last who died and came to life. What point is Jesus making? I am eternal, and I will always have dominion. I am the first and the last. None before me, none after me. I have eternal dominion. And what is he saying? Who died and came to life. What's his point? I have had victory over death. I don't have to be afraid of it. I died and I came back. I have conquered death. I mean, that's what Jesus is saying, isn't it? What did he do? Why did he do it? We'll go back to Hebrews 2:14. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of these things. Isn't that talking about his birth? Becoming a human? Sharing in flesh and blood? That's what the birth of Christ is all about. Deity itself, deity himself becoming flesh. That's what the birth of Christ is. That's why it's such a momentous occurrence. That's why it's so amazing. But why did he do that? So that he could die like us. So that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. That slavery that the fear of death subjects us to, that it's all about this life, it's all about the material, and it could come at any moment, and I have to live my life in such a way that I can derive every ounce of pleasure, and I might be dead at any time, so I've got to shield myself from danger. That fear of death does not have power over you. Why? Because of the death and resurrection of Christ. What is he saying? He's claiming eternal dominion, the first and the last. He's reminding them of his victory over death. And he's telling and demonstrating that he has the power to grant that same victory to his followers. I've already done it, guys. This is Jesus talking as Jesus. I've already had victory over death. I've already put to death his power. I've already destroyed that power. And I will grant that victory to who? To those who are faithful until they die. To the one who conquers. I will grant this. Jesus. And you think about the life of Jesus, from birth to death, the partaking of flesh, to die in the same way that we do. The whole point of that was that so as he was victorious over death, now I can live without that fear. And that attitude that Paul has, isn't that the opposite of the fear of death? That attitude that Paul has, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. I wish that I could die and go be with him, for that is far better for me. It's not just that he doesn't fear death, but isn't Paul kind of looking forward to it? Isn't he kind of eager for it? And isn't that the way it is? I mean, you think about this life and all the things of this life. We think about what we're promised in heaven. That is better. So not only do I not live with the fear of death anymore, not only do I have to be afraid of my death, but I can live in such a way that whenever death comes, I can welcome it with open arms. And that allows me to live as God would have me live. I don't have to worry about physical possessions. I don't have to worry about wealth. I don't have to worry about social standing. I don't have to worry about any of the things that go along with the material life. I don't have to worry about any of that because I'm looking forward to something better, something greater, because Christ has given me that victory. Are you afraid of death?